It being the feast of the dedication of this church, I intend to do what I did at the patronal festival and to talk about where I've got up to in terms of my research into the history of this parish. And today I want to talk particularly about the background to the ecclesial life of this parish, particularly in the late 19th and early 20th century, a period about which I've not known a great deal, and I'm trying to get a feel for what life was like in this suburb in those years. But first of all, I need to talk briefly about Bishop Neville, because you just can't get away from him in any consideration of any kind of history of Anglicanism in this part of the world. And ask anybody who thinks they know the slightest smattering of things about the beginnings of the Anglican Church in Otago and Southland, and they'll mention the Bishop Jenner incident. You recall this is the clergyman who was consecrated as the first Bishop of Dunedin, who was then spotted taking part in a church service in London of advanced ritualistic tendencies. Word got back here, and really that poisoned the whole atmosphere against him, and he was prevented from taking up his see. But you know, this incident is really a non-issue in the life of this diocese, because Bishop Neville had four things: drive, determination, energy, and money. He was a man who made things happen. And you know, Jenner, when he was thrust aside, took a quiet country living and wrote hymns and things like that. We sing one of his hymns from time to time. "We love the place, O God," often sung at institutions. In other words, what I'm saying, he was a gentle creature, a man of tranquil disposition. He wasn't the kind of driving personality who would make things happen in a diocese struggling to be born. And Neville, for all his irascibility, his tendency to fall out with people and cause unnecessary fights, was the kind of guy who made things happen, who planted parishes, who got things on the move. And of course he'd married money. So where the diocese didn't have it, he'd supply it. And, you know, when he retired in 1919, he was bishop for a very long time. He kind of left a structural deficit that the diocese has struggled to fulfill ever since in terms of its perpetually cash-starved existence. In the 1950s and 1960s, those were the salad days for the diocese. The economy was booming. The baby boomer generation like me was sent along to Sunday school, returned to the church. That kind of concealed the problems for a couple of decades. But really, what was left of the legacy of Neville retiring in 1919 is still with us. I might add that in many ways he was a concealed high churchman. There's an amazing photograph of the opening ceremony of Holy Cross St Kilda, in which the then vicar of this parish, Reverend Evans, an Anglo-Papalist, is assisting at a pontifical high mass, and there's Bishop Neville dressed up to the nines, chasuble, maniple, mitre, the works. And I think that he wasn't just doing that because now he was a private of New Zealand and thought he could get away with anything. I think he was doing this out of what he wanted to do also. I want to turn now to what life was like in the suburb and things that are different to life now. You know, this suburb broke down into sub-districts. Up there was Rocky Side, the area where most of the people were unskilled workmen, the poorest area in the suburb. It doesn't exist anymore. It's been swept away by the Southern Motorway. And that housed the Home for Fallen Women, run by the Salvation Army. At the end of Eastbourne Street here was the benevolent institution known by the locals as the Benny. Huge Dickensian-like structure. It stood there in almost magnificent isolation at first. And this is where you went if you had arrived at the end of your days with no money. A lot of derelict old men there. There was also an industrial school somewhere else in the suburb for what a later age would call juvenile delinquents. Kensington, over that away, was much more heavily populated than it is today because many of the workers who worked in the factories here lived there. There were a couple of breweries, There was a factory for making sanitary pipes. There was a brickworks or two, as well as the railway workshops. And the workers in those places lived as close as they could. It would have been a very smoky and polluted environment. All the shunting yards from the railway station were close by. The gas works were in full operation, plus all these factories. This area is what was known as Parkside for very obvious reasons. I want to talk now about the issue of to what extent St. Peter's Caversham was a rallying point for people of Anglo-Saxon origins, what we call in historical circles the issue of ethnicity. Was it a case of, you know, raise the flag of St. George and all English people over here, please, to exercise your spiritual responsibilities? Well, you know, Caversham was known as the English suburb. Even its most famous Presbyterian minister, the Reverend Dutton, had come from the Black Country, not from Scotland. And in order to test this thesis, what Eric Olson, who's the great historian behind the Caversham Project, has suggested I do is get a look at the marriage registers. Up until 1890, most of the weddings that took place in this neck of the woods were of people who'd been born in Britain. After 1900, over half the weddings would have been people born in New Zealand. And there's a book called The Rival Jerusalems, which argues that the Church of England, in England, where it was strong, nonconformity and free churches were weak. Where it was weak, free churches and nonconformity was strong. And to find out from where the brides and grooms came from, to try and determine whether this was a rallying point for ethnicity. Of course, the two groups who were marginalised in the life of the suburb were the Lebanese and the Chinese. You know, the Chinese were mostly guys who had been in the gold rush that had come to an end, and they came here to be market gardeners. They worked hard to help train the suburb, paddling away on their little water wheels. They were well known because they would often sell their produce door to door, but they really had to know their place. Really interesting that on the vestry of the building of the first church in 1864, there was a guy with a Chinese name. I'd be mighty interested to find out why he was on the vestry. And the Lebanese, who had arrived as Maronite Christians, were absorbed after a while into the Catholic community. But it's interesting that, you know, the Idor family, well-known name around here, they were the first of the Lebanese families to be prepared to marry outside their own ethnic grouping. And there's a publication produced by this parish in the mid-1950s in which it lists proudly a medical missionary, I think serving in Hong Kong, called Margaret Idor. Well, she'd clearly married into the Idor family, so they're, you know, they'd become Anglicans, that branch of that family. And I want to talk now about the issue of class, which is really big in this neck of the woods. You know, New Zealanders, our ancestors, when they arrived here in the 19th century, were determined not to think of themselves in class terms. They thought they'd left all that behind in the old world. And there were some things that worked against any kind of class identity forming in this country. Because, for instance, the workforce was highly mobile in the 19th century. Men moving from place to place often to seek work. And they talked about these men being divided into two groups. There were the strivers, the ones who were working hard to get enough money to buy a house and establish a family, and the derelicts, the ones who had given up on the project, who were now just struggling for survival and trying to anaesthetise themselves as much as possible with booze. And that worked against class formation. But the great polarising event was the Great Maritime Strike of 1890, where workers did come together in combination to oppose their employers. Well, the employers won the strike, and many of those attempted groupings into unions dissolved. But here from 1890 on, even before that, people were thinking of themselves in class terms. And that's the point that Eric Olson makes in his book, Building the New World, that when men met each other in this suburb, which they called the flat in those days, they automatically assessed each other and ranked each other on where they stood in the skill hierarchy of work. And the thesis is that that the kind of people who tended to come to a church like this tended to be skilled working class and respectable working class. That is to say, people who thought of themselves as advancing themselves by sheer hard work, by saving, and tended to look down on the unskilled as being feckless, gormless people who were the author of their own misfortunes. People who were more disciplined in their lifestyle, more temperate in their kind of emotional range. And I'm inclined to accept that point of view. I've operated in parishes like this for most of my ministry, and it's tended to be respectable working class people who made up the membership, and some white collar workers as well. And of course the issue of class plays in reverse also. Remember when I was talking last time about the way in which the matriarchy of St. Clair established St. Peter the Less and wanted it to be very different to St. Peter's Caversham. And what puzzled me was, why did they seek to put themselves under the aegis of Holy Cross St. Kilda? The sociology of the two areas seemed to be so different. Well, back then, in the early 20th century, St. Kilda had a much higher percentage of people from the skilled working class and the white collar workers than Caversham did. So in other words, St. Clair felt a greater commonality with St. Kilda than they did with here. St. Kilda was also very popular as a place for young families to get started. Land was comparatively cheap. It was a go-ahead area, not the way it is now, where often it's, you know, people left behind in home ownership flats and transient population of people moving through. It was very different. Now, the perception was that people, the lower down the scale you were in working class circles, particularly unskilled workers, tended not to be churchgoers at all. So that's a thesis I've got to test. Certainly the Victorian church back in Britain was highly aware that it had lost the working class and made Herculean efforts to regain them through the abolition of the pew rent system, through the establishment of new parishes in working class area, through the launching of missions. There are even things called labour churches. Well, the church here wasn't quite that energetic, but the church that was perceived to be the most successful with unskilled working class people was the Salvation Army, with its black and white theology, its highly theatrical way of operating. Interesting, isn't it? The Salvation Army isn't here in Caversham at all right now. And there's been a recent development in the last year which is portentous of their future. They've pulled everything back to that social service area, you know, like down the one-way street, which is their main worship area. And up until recently, they've had a reasonably successful missionary church operating in the North East Valley, which they've just closed in the last few months and pulled everything back to the centre, to the distress of those who are worshipping in that little citadel there in the North East Valley. Well, the two complaints, particularly of unskilled working class men about churches and why they didn't attend them, was they're after your money. And the other thing was you have to dress up to go to church. And as I was explaining in my article in The Rock this month, well, to some extent the churches were after your money. They were struggling to get going. The other thing is that the major concerns about crime in the 19th century were vagrancy, drunkenness, and larrikinism. Larrikinism provoked a great deal of what we call social panic. These were gangs of disaffected working class youths who wandered around causing trouble. And what they particularly liked to do was to throw stones at churches during Sunday morning service. Just loved to throw them on the roofs and the windows. Got people really quite concerned. Well, at least it doesn't happen to us now, does it? I mean, it's a bit more tranquil on Sunday morning. And big efforts were made to try and solve the problem. And, you know, this is partly what's behind the drive towards prohibition. There's two major mass mobilizations take place in this suburb in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. The first of them is launched by women, the first wave feminists and suffragettes, who had a four-point program: votes for women, the abolition of the sale of alcohol, Bible in schools, and a strict keeping of the Sabbath. It's women who are pushing for that, particularly in the free churches. Rather embarrassingly, some prominent Anglicans were prominent in the liquor industry and opposed all that, but it's all right, we can feel morally superior because they were worshippers at the cathedral and All Saints, they weren't here. The other mass mobilisation was of workers to begin to form craft unions to campaign for better pay and conditions, and also to regulate who could enter their industry through what kind of apprenticeship system. So you begin to get the beginnings of mobilised labour in this neck of the woods, but it's a very temperate and moderate kind of unionism, not like the Red Feds and the syndicalists in the North Island. And the Liberal government comes to power in the 1890s and stays in power until the early 20th century. You know, this is King Dick and Prime Minister Ward, first Catholic Prime Minister of New Zealand. They are prepared to meet these demands, to put in place the arbitration system, to do something about proper working hours and paying conditions. And so, in a sense, that mobilisation succeeded very well. Well, just to conclude then, given all this, given these mobilisations, given the way life was in this neck of the woods, can we be surprised that Canon Brian King, the man who changed everything in this parish in terms of its worship style, was mightily interested in social questions because his father had been a vicar in the East End of London, that his son, Vincent King, also ordained, first ordained to help his dad out in his parish, becomes the great social worker priest, that wonderful title, chaplain to public institutions in the interwar period, and the man who, remember I told you, directed the effort to run the city during the great influenza epidemic of November 1918. Or the fact that Father John Mortimer, vicar here in the Great War, was a Christian socialist and very interested in social questions and issues, because it was a kind of an inescapable part of this very dynamic suburb that was, until 1940, the most densely settled and populated part of New Zealand, a really interesting community. Well, that's it for now.